Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from John Richardson and Jack Crandall in chemistry. I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:40 Central Time in sports. It's North Carolina sitting on top of the Associated Press men's college basketball poll. Following last weekend's win over Duke, the Tar Heels received 52 first-place votes from the 72-member national media panel. It's North Carolina's second week in its second stint as the number one team. The Tar Heels were on top of the preseason top 25 and the first 10 polls of the regular season. The top five teams all held their spots from last week, with Memphis at number two, followed by UCLA, Tennessee, and Kansas. Also in this week's poll, Wisconsin, Purdue, Notre Dame, Michigan State, and Indiana. Connecticut, North Carolina, and Tennessee remain the top three teams in the Associated Press women's top 25. The Huskies received 49 first-place votes, with the Tar Heels getting the other first-place ballot. Stanford and Maryland round out the top five. It was quite a run for the University of Illinois women's basketball team at the Big Ten tourney. Ultimately, though, they didn't get it done. Purdue's Lakeisha Freeman grabbed her own rebound with a second left and beat the buzzer with a 10-foot jumper, giving the Boilermakers a 58-56 victory over Illinois in the Big Ten tournament championship. Purdue will make its 15th straight appearance in the NCAA tournament this year after clinching the conference's automatic bid by defending its 2007 tourney title yesterday. The Boilermakers were led by Freeman with 12 points. Illinois was led by Jenna Smith with 19 points and 12 rebounds. Four more NCAA tournament berths will be clinched tonight on the college hardwoods. There are men's championship games on tap in the CAA, Metro Atlantic Athletic Conference, Southern Conference, and West Coast Conference. And there are three NHL games on tonight's schedule, including the Buffalo Rangers hosting the New York Rangers. The Sabres come in trailing idle Philadelphia by 4 points for the final playoff spot in the East. Buffalo plays five of its next seven games on home ice. The Blues and the Hawks are off tonight, as are the Bulls and the Pacers in the NBA. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of the Conference Center development located within the University of Illinois South Research Campus, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:43. With the proposed future gen power plant on hiatus, it's unclear which path so-called clean coal research will take next. Future gen was to turn coal into hydrogen before burning it to generate electricity and to inject the resulting carbon dioxide deep into the ground, all at one single plant near Mattoon. But as AM580's Tom Rogers reports, other projects using portions of that technology are already taking root.
Mattoon won the competitive bidding process for the Future Gen plant last year over three other sites, including the Permian Basin region of West Texas. There, oil is the big industry. A power plant company called Tenaska now wants to build a plant in that same area that incorporates a major facet of Future Gen, sequestering the carbon dioxide from the burning process deep underground. Bart Ford is Tenaska's vice president of business development.
Right now we really like the project, and we're able to develop it on our own and very excited about it.
Note that Ford said, on our own. That's quite different from Future Gen's original concept. More than a dozen coal and utility companies were to put up $400 million, and federal funds would fund the balance of the $1.8 billion demonstration plant. And the companies of the Future Gen Alliance would share the results of its research. The Bush administration's goal is to make carbon dioxide capture, coal gasification, and other technologies more useful in the commercial realm. And for Tenaska's plant in Texas, commercial viability would come from miles of oil fields. Ford says oil companies could buy the CO2 and then force it underground when wells using conventional drilling methods peter out.
Carbon dioxide, just because of its physical characteristics, is especially good for squeezing the oil out of the ground. And I know the estimate for the value of the oil that can be produced through this technique is about $1 billion per year with the carbon dioxide that the plant will be able to produce.
Ford says the CO2 would stay underground instead of leaching out into the atmosphere. But the project is still in the planning stages, and future Jet Alliance CEO Michael Mudd says that's where such projects get tied up. He says companies have to find financing and generate profit as well as power.
And I'm not inclined to try to advance the technology and take technology risks, because if I fail to deliver on those contracts, I will have to pay liquidated damages to the person that expects to receive those powers. And because I'm using my own money, I have no incentive to share that with other people.
Mudd believes opening technological advances to public use will get the latest pollution control techniques into coal-fired plants quicker. And so far, despite all the plans, there are very few actual plants that sequester carbon dioxide or use coal gasification, which greatly cuts down on pollutants that give coal a bad name. FutureGen was supposed to do both at once. Steve Blankenship, an editor with the trade magazine Power Engineering, says that idea was more intriguing a few years ago when the price tag for FutureGen was closer to $1 billion.
But at $1.8 billion and climbing, to put all those eggs into that one basket, I think some of the administrators in D.C. thought, you know, maybe this is not the best way to spend the public money.
Why? Blankenship says other cutting-edge plants could sell CO2 to the oil industry, but no one knows if there would be a market for the gas elsewhere. And he says one of FutureGen's marketable byproducts was supposed to be hydrogen.
Remember 5 or 6 years ago, we were all headed toward a hydrogen economy. That was what everybody seemed to think, or at least a lot of people think. You know, that would mean that we were going to be replacing our internal combustion engines in our cars with fuel cells, which would run on hydrogen and not on gasoline.
But Blankenship says the momentum has since swung to plug-in hybrid electric cars. There went the potential market for hydrogen. So where does that leave FutureGen? $156 million was earmarked for it in this federal budget year, according to Phil Bloomer, an assistant to Illinois Congressman Tim Johnson. Now that money may be sent to other projects in what the Energy Department calls a restructuring of the FutureGen initiative. That money could be used as incentives for private sector projects. But Bloomer says that would be wasting the millions of dollars already pumped into studying the Mattoon site.
This project is already 5 years down the road. It's the only one that is that far along. So to go through the due diligence process that these folks already have, it's just silly.
Some companies like Tenaska think it might be worth the trouble, not only with its plant idea for West Texas, but for one in central Illinois. Regulators are looking at a proposed plant near Taylorville that would use coal gasification. It would be owned by Tenaska. But Mudd says the FutureGen proposal would pave the way for cleaner coal plants sooner.
And the question is, can you put the cart before the horse? Is the marketplace truly ready to accept the risk and the unknowns associated with plants with carbon capture and sequestration absent FutureGen? I firmly believe that when you look at the marketplace, that it's not there.
The answer to that question may be clearer in the next few months, as bids come in for federal money under the newly restructured FutureGen plan. I'm Tom Rogers, AM 580 News.
News of economic downturn is everywhere. Foreclosures, layoffs, and other financial problems are making it real for a lot of people. But the uneasy climate also means some financially stable folks start cutting back on their spending. This kind of belt tightening has significant consequences for small specialty businesses. They depend on consumer confidence to stay afloat. Diantha Parker reports on the fortunes of a shop in Chicago's Lincoln Square neighborhood.
You need a certain kind of customer base to support a shop that sells mostly cheese. These people often have some extra money and have had the opportunity to develop a taste for your fancier cheddars. For almost 5 years, a store in Lincoln Square called The Cheese Stands Alone attracted a lot of these folks and did pretty well as a result.
Do you want gooier or just super rich?
Neither one of them.
You want the triple cream in it.
Okay.
But no more. Owner Matt Parker, no relation, closed his doors a couple of weeks ago.
The last summer was the best summer we've ever had. I didn't have a slow day or more than two of them all summer. And then as soon as fall came, it just died.
Parker wonders if his iffy location, a few blocks away from the denser shopping on Lincoln Avenue, was his downfall. He also thinks the economy is discouraging people from spending on extras. Another owner says it definitely is. Julie Schneider owns Hubba Hubba, a women's clothing boutique with two Northside locations.
In the past, people will make an assortment of what they like, and it's like, okay, write me up. This looks great. And it seems like in the past year, it's kind of like, well, I like this, but I don't need that one, so let's put that one back. And this one, I think I have something like this. And they'll whittle it down to an item or two.
Schneider says in nearly 20 years of business, 2007 was the first year Hubba Hubba's profits went down. University of Chicago economist Eric Hurst says consumer discouragement always starts small.
People have preferences. I like X and Y, and you like Z. So if I like X and Y more than you do, I'm going to be more likely to keep spending on X and Y. If you like Z more than me, you're going to be more likely to spend on Z.
Moderately well-off people spending a bit less money may not sound bad, especially when foreclosures and layoffs are at record highs. But Hearst says even the perception of economic danger can eventually do real damage.
Even if we're not going into recessions, because the economists think we might in some states of the world, which I think most of us do think, you know, maybe things could be bad enough to push us into recessions, then you know, the consumers hear that. And when the consumers hear that, it affects their spending today.
It's hard to find people who feel good about the economy now, even on State Street and the Magnificent Mile.
It's really messed up. You know, we used to take the kids out often and can't do all that. And
not spending the big grande, going to little grande, but also, too, in terms of my traveling.
Pam Hampton and James Connolly say they're holding off on big-ticket items, but they'll keep buying themselves little luxuries. And so will two of the Cheese Stands Alone's most faithful customers.
I like goat cheese.
Ed Soderstrom and his wife Eileen were weekly regulars.
Every Friday I pick up at work, then we get two movies, and then come by here and get some cheese, then go to a wine store and go back home, drink some wine, eat some cheese, and watch a movie.
The Soderstroms say they'll need a new source of cheese. Shop owner Matt Parker says he does hope to reopen at some point when the economy is a little better for businesses like his. I'm Diantha Parker.
At private universities in the U.S., campus police are not subject to the same public scrutiny as city police. Students across the nation have been trying to change that. A state panel in Connecticut has ruled that Yale's police are bound by the same open records laws as those that serve the city. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
Yale's police records were pried open almost accidentally when two Yale police officers arrested a New Haven teenager who was riding his bike on a city sidewalk last year. His attorney suspected racial profiling. And as she often does with New Haven City Police, Janet Perotti asked for the officers' personnel records to check for other complaints. Perotti says she was stunned when Yale refused, claiming campus officers were private employees and not subject to public records laws.
I thought, how absurd. This was a police officer with all the same police powers as a New Haven police officer. Arresting citizens, and not even on campus. It just defies any type of logic that you're not a cop.
Yale declined to be interviewed for this report. In legal papers, they argue that even though Yale police, quote, admittedly perform a government function, they are not government agents subject to public scrutiny. But Perotti says common sense and fairness dictate otherwise.
If you dress like a cop, you act like a cop, you should be held accountable as a cop.
Perotti took the case to Connecticut's Freedom of Information Commission, who agreed and ordered Yale to hand the records over.
This really was not a close call for us.
Lisa Siegel is staff attorney for the commission.
These police officers carry guns, make arrests, and have a profound impact on people's lives, and yet they were considered themselves not accountable at all. And that, to us, was kind of astounding.
Connecticut's open record laws are broader than most. When the issue has come up at schools in other states, courts have gone the other way, siding with campus police in Georgia, Virginia, and Massachusetts, where the highest court ruled that Harvard's police were not required to share the incident reports that student reporters had requested. Legislation is pending to make sure all campus police records see the light of day, but Harvard spokesperson Kevin Casey says that would do more harm than good.
Generally, there's a view in the public that more sunshine is better, but we do fear that you can almost go a little bit too far in terms of having every single interaction become a public event.
Casey says campus police are already required to publicly report arrests, and they do. But he says many students will only seek help if they believe police will be discreet. Enforcing officers to report their every move, Casey says, would have a chilling effect.
We want to have a culture where people feel comfortable informing an authoritative figure without the fear that it's going to become front page news. And you have sort of a paparazzi climate, and nobody will report concerns that should have been raised.
Those clamoring for more openness call that a red herring. Even if police records were shared, they say, students' most personal information would still be kept private. At Yale, student newspaper editor Andrew Mangino says schools like Yale may be trying to protect their image, but may end up doing more damage.
There's a culture here of making sure that negative information does not get out there. There is, I think, the perception in New Haven that Yale is somewhat of a secret society and that Yale is not subject to the same sorts of rules that the rest of New Haven is.
Yale still has a few weeks to comply with the order to hand over their records or appeal to the courts. Sheldon Steinbach, an attorney who's represented colleges for decades, says forcing campus police to open their books would create problems where there really are none.
Only irrational, paranoid individuals would be concerned about a rogue cop on campus, because overwhelmingly, most campus police are honest, diligent, professional policemen.
Maybe, says Janet Perotti, the public defender who started the fight at Yale. But if so, she says, the university should have no qualms about turning over the officers' personnel records she's been asking for. Dovia Smith, NPR News.
Earth and sky.
We currently take quite a bit of food out of the food system and put it over into the energy system where it ends up in our cars.
That's Joachim von Braun, Director General of the International Food Policy Research Institute, which tries to provide sustainable solutions based on science for ending global hunger. He said that in the developing world, the emerging link between the world's food and fuel economies means higher food prices and more hunger for the poor, while creating some opportunities for some farmers.
Let's not forget that most of the energy consumption in the world is by rich people, whereas food is really absolutely critical for the poorer 2 billion people.
Von Braun's computer models show that for every 1% increase in food prices, the poor spend 0.75% less on food. He said biofuels from corn, sugar, and oilseeds are driving food prices up.
The current biofuel policy is a mess in North America, in the U.S., and in Europe. It undermines the food situation of the poor in the world, whereas it is good that we have entered this sector of biofuels with the current technology. It's not fair and it's not productive. So scale up science and go slow on the expansion with the current technology is my take-home message.
This is Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Seaboat, featuring a southern style of cooking walleye and catfish, chicken, shrimp, sandwiches, and more, available for dine-in and carry-out. The Seaboat, 402 West Kirby, across from Jerry's IGA in Champaign. Catering services available at 355-9933.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 33 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the U of I. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director today is Henry Frayne. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight: in southeastern Indiana, partly to mostly cloudy with a few snow showers and flurries. Elsewhere, clear to partly cloudy, lows ranging from 20 in northwestern Illinois to 28 in southern Illinois. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs ranging from 40 in northeastern Indiana to 60 in southwestern Illinois. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, looking for a low of 23. Tomorrow, sunny, breezy, warmer, the high 55. The outlook for tomorrow night, clear to partly cloudy, the low 32. Wednesday, partly sunny and mild, the high near 60. Up next here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, it's The World from PRI. Stay tuned.